I know so far there's been a lot of kind of talking at you stuff, so this is meant to be more talk back. I do have a few basic things I'd like to run through at some point. Let's start this way. Since a lot of you don't know each other, and we're almost a small enough group for this to work, let's just go up and down the pews and just stand, say your name, and the watershed you are from, if you know it, and if you don't, when you're going to learn it. Tyler, you want to start, and we'll just go up and down the rows. Everybody get a chance to say their name? Yeah. It's a simple exercise, Karen, to just, you know, for a minute, rather than giving the typical name, rank, serial number, city, to just start thinking in new ways. These are simple but actually consequential habits for us to renew. Let's just have a little moment, and someone who has got good eyes and can read that in a nice, strong voice, who feels like they want it. Sarah, you want to do that into the mic? This is a beautiful Wendell Berry poem.
All that passes descends and ascends again unseen into the light. The river coming down from sky to hills, from hills to sea, and carving as it moves, to rise invisible, gathered to light to return again. The river's injury is its shape. I've learned no more. We are what we are given and what is taken away. Blessed be the name of the giver and the taker, for everything that comes is a gift, the meaning always carried out of sight, to renew our whereabouts, always a starting place. And every gift is perfect in its beginning, for it is from above and cometh down from the Father of lights. Gravity is grace. All that has come to us has come as the river comes, given in passing away. And if our wickedness destroys the watershed, dissolves the beautiful field, then I must grieve and learn.
Many of the early prophets of what we're calling watershed discipleship, in fact, were artists, literary figures, not theologians or sociologists. And it's important in this work that we always give lots of room for the artistic and the literary and the symbolic, because this is about replacing but also renewing our imagination, our imaginary, how we not just think about the world, but symbol the world and reproduce it in our cultural forms. And I want to talk some about how the church in particular does that. But just to review, how many of you, I know many of you here have heard me flap my gums about watershed discipleship a number of times, but how many of you is it this relatively new concept? So maybe half. So I do want to just hit a few more high notes from what I pretty quickly went over in the plenary. Connection timed out. What does that mean, Jinsu? Retry. Connection timed out. Wow, that's deep. Got it. Our connection, folks, is timing out, which is why we've got to be thinking about this. Of talking about geography as theology. I believe, is not a cosmetic idea. I think this actually strikes at the heart of the civilizational crisis. And I, you know, I'm happy to unpack that a little with you. But the truth is, and this is why it's important sometimes to introduce ourselves in terms of watersheds, when we think of how we usually frame our identity, it is usually done in what we might call social terms, this family, this church, this clan maybe, and those are good things. But when it comes to identifying ourselves in terms of space or place, we're a little adrift or a lot adrift. And so we will typically identify ourselves according to institutions, our social locations, or after that, it's usually some sort of political definition of place. I'm from this city, I'm from this state. And those things are very, I'm from this nation. Those things are not without consequence, that way of thinking about ourselves. And the opportunity, the most, in my opinion, the most revolutionary aspect of the watershed discipleship paradigm is to attack the deepest roots of identity according to political geography, which usually actually means ideology, and to strike at the root of that with the axe of geomorphology, because that's a fundamentally theological approach to the world. That is, if we believe that God created the earth, A. And if we believe that fluvial geomorphology is the chief design feature of that creation, B, then what would it mean for the church to completely rearrange its imaginary and its sense of identity to have our primary sense of relationship be with the design feature of creation in which we inhabit, rather than even things like not just political allegiance or social identification, but indeed denominational identity. Now, I'm not against those things. I just think we have to keep first things first, and it has been our loss of first things that has gotten us into this mess. Now, those of you who know me as someone with anarchist leanings, I mean, I don't Twitter about it like more sophisticated anarchists sitting in the front pew who are really able to communicate that in social media, which is kind of an interesting anarchist space all in and of itself to some extent. But for me, you know, this is a paradigm that in fact transcends the state. In fact, it undermines the state. And whether one is anarchist or just has a healthy suspicion of the way in which the state dominates our imaginary, or whether one is an old Anabaptist who's looking for ways of being Christian that aren't overdetermined by the state control of our Christian imagination. That's what the original Anabaptist movement was all about. This is a very rich paradigm, in my opinion, and an extremely subversive one to the prevailing way of thinking. So this isn't just green window dressing. This actually is the consequences of beginning to rethink everything through a watershed paradigm, in my opinion, is sort of a bottomless well. We talked a little bit about these two images, and I just want to go back to them because I just by way of underlining, when I talk about the chief design feature, and I want to make sure that was clear to everybody what I mean when I say that. That you're looking at the earth from, 30,000 feet here. And the only, or the most distinctive thing that one sees is the way water flows. And it is precisely that which has disappeared under the modern built environment. The pipe sheds, right? So much of the way the water flows, in fact, has been disappeared. And you know, that seems like just a practical matter, right? We got to get the storm water out, and we've got to make sure that our lowlands don't flood and that our roadways don't get too. But the way in which we treat the water, I want you to think of what we do with water. We divert it. We submerge it. We corral it. That's what we do to people, too, who are a little too wild or a little too free or maybe a little too inconvenient. So there's always a social corollary to these dysfunctional ecological practices. Traditional cultures simply didn't do that. They lived with the way the water flows. They knew where the flood zones were and took care about that. They lived proximate to water because water is life. They made sure that there were reasonable delivery systems that worked without fundamentally changing the fluvial geomorphology. And it wasn't just because they were unable to do that, because actually it doesn't take that much to dam a river or divert a river. But one finds a curious absence even of engineered irrigation among traditional cultures around the world. Civilization began with engineered irrigation, the changing of water flows. And I just want us to understand the deeper critique here, that how we treat water is how inevitably we treat everything else. Theologically, to me, theology is an intrinsic part of this conversation for us. It's an important part of this conversation. And it's no accident, you know, this would be a proof text of activist Christians, right? We all know this text from Amos. Let justice roll down like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream. But have we ever stopped to ask why Amos would compare justice to fluvial geomorphology? What are two things about this that fluvial geomorphology teaches us about justice? What are two aspects that Amos names? Okay, it's natural, but let's talk design feature here.
It's out of our control.
Okay, it's out of our control when in its natural state. Right. It is. There's a circulatory aspect of this that is regenerative or never failing. Right. Okay. So that's one. That justice is regenerative. You can trust justice because it will not fail, unlike its counterpart. What's another aspect? Okay, you don't mess with it. Like there are other parts. Actually, Scripture Jeremiah talks about the difference between God as a fount of life. I alluded to the psalmist who says that, but Jeremiah talks about in the prophetic critique of Israel, you have ignored God as the fount, the spring of the water of life. It's over and over in Scripture, it becomes difficult to distinguish God from water. And don't yell at me, I didn't write this stuff. It's right there. And then Jeremiah contrasts that with, instead you trust in your cracked cisterns, your attempts to divert and corral water that are cracked and aren't working for you. So you abandon the way that water occurs in creation, and your re-engineering efforts inevitably fail you. This is an ancient critique. There's nothing new about watershed discipleship. This is just a reclamation project here. What's another? We're still missing some stuff here. Yeah, Mark. Water is very powerful. It's practitioners, Mike, of nonviolence talk about the force more powerful, but it's patient, and it takes a long time. But inevitably, it prevails against the great. And there's lots of images of that in Scripture. I'm still waiting for the gravity piece to kick in. Yes, sister.
And I think of freedom, that the water is free to do what it was designed to do. Mm. And when I think about justice, I think about people being able to be free to do what they were created by our creators.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, there's so much here. Yes, Aaron?
It flows to the lowest places. And
gravity is grace. Gravity is grace. Water wants to flow downward. That's a social vision. Water flows to the lowest places. It wants to find equilibrium where there is the calm of level. And I think that's the primary reason why Amos uses this metaphor, because he's in the middle of talking about rich and poor and powerful and vulnerable. And like Jesus later would do, talks about God's unique inhabitation among those in the lowest places. And justice and power and goodness need to flow and seek the lowest places in order to find that equilibrium of level. And at the same time, it's rolling. It has to flow, because what happens when water is dammed up? It stagnates. It becomes what John the Baptist calls dirty water. What's another life liquid that has that same issue? Blood. Right? So we're talking about some really primal stuff here. It's very theological, but it's also very ecological, and you almost can't figure out the difference. That kind of thinking is, I believe, where we need to go. I hope this isn't too basic, but I guess it's not, because we haven't gotten it. So I want to revisit John Wesley Powell's definition, because I want it to be one of those tropes that you remember coming out of this weekend. by the way, this definition is still used on the USGS website. That's how amazingly concise John Wesley Powell. A very interesting dude, by the way, who after surveying the West on behalf of the U.S. government in the 1880s, got into a fight as Western states were being surveyed. There were two forces in Congress lobbying for how state lines should be drawn. Are you following me? Right? Of the arid West. Like what? What should be the boundaries of Arizona or New Mexico or Utah? And the railroads were one lobbying force, saying we need straight lines because we need to survey the land into industrial agricultural grids because we're encouraging farmers to settle this land and tame this land and only straight railroad lines and straight political boundaries are going to help that be done. And so they had their map of how the western states should be drawn. And John Wesley Powell was saying, Arizona ain't Pennsylvania. This is the arid country. And water is everything out here. And if we don't conform our social life and become part of this arid community, we're going to end up fighting over water. You think? And so he actually drew a watershed proposal for state boundaries in the West. Now, okay, yeah, he's still dealing with the U.S. government and state lines. I get it. But imagine how prescient it was in the 1880s to be drawing watershed maps so that the watershed map you saw is actually based on the work that John Wesley Powell did in the 1890s. He lost, right? I mean, who could go up against the railroad barons and the ranching barons? But it's a really interesting piece of U.S. history. So the fundamental assertion of watershed discipleship is, first and foremost, we live in a watershed moment. That's important because of the historical crisis we're in. You can't leave that part out. This is not, we are the world, let's all become a little greener, and there are not urgent issues at stake. This is life and death stuff. This is time, this is our connection timing out. And so we are in a watershed moment, which means we have to rethink everything. Now again, that's not unique. The entire scriptural tradition is written in the consciousness that we are in a watershed moment, because this has cycled through the history of civilization as the prophets see the issues, name the crisis, and call people to awaken to it. But our crisis is truly unprecedented. And we better get literate in that real fast, if we are not already, in my opinion. But the second piece is what we might call a geoanthropological statement of factness. We all live in a watershed, no exceptions. It's just the way it is, whether you know it or not, whether you care about it or not. And certainly, whether or not you know the boundaries of your watershed, you live in one. And that's true whether you're urban or inner city or suburban or rural or in the middle of a strip mine. You're in a watershed. And therefore, if we want to be incarnational, that is, people who are actually engaging body and place, we're going to have to engage our watersheds. Why has that never been part of the discipleship conversation in our churches? And I try to suggest that it's the long, sordid history of placeless docetism that has distracted us and diverted us and undergrounded us and corralled us, just like we do water. As the water flows, I guess, so theology goes. I think my connection has timed out again. Oh no, there we are. That's the generic slide. Is that the end of the slideshow? I don't think it is, but that's what the wireless thing is telling me. So maybe this is a good time to stop and just see if we're clear on those first two things, and just some of the rudimentary ideas of this kind of remapping of consciousness and remapping of political and social imagination. I just want to know if it's relatively clear. And if it's not, I want to try to make sure we are clear about it. It's not rocket science. In fact, it's really not rocket science. It's geomorphology. But yeah, Phil.
I'm very attracted to this because of its sort of revolutionary way of rethinking our political ideas and our political identity. Mm-hmm. And I think why isn't it just another colonial map? That is, why isn't it simply another way of having a consciousness of controlling an area, controlling the headwater, controlling the identity of a space? This is my state, this is my nation, this is my area. That now it's not Ojibwe, it's not Dakota, it's not those boundaries. It's a new boundary that a human being is putting over the space. And so it might be a better, but isn't it still human beings doing what we do?
Okay.
For better or worse?
Yeah. That's a great question. That's a fair question, and it inevitably arises from perhaps an overemphasis on mapping, particularly Western style mapping, two dimensional mapping, aerial mapping, drone mapping. I was just at a watershed conference that had a workshop on using drones to do permaculture surveys, and I just found myself getting a headache. But anyway, so that's a fair question and an open question. Obviously, we human beings have demonstrated that we have the ingenuity and the inclination to whitewash any paradigm and colonize any paradigm. There are two things that give me confidence in this as a way of moving forward. One is that when one looks at native mapping, and that is actually now more and more people are trying to recover native mapping. And as a matter of fact, Doug Aberle, from whom I first learned 25 years ago about watershed mapping in a little book called Boundaries of Home. Doug was one of the early bioregionalists who was pushing a watershed paradigm. In subsequent years, in the last 25 years, he's gone into a native mapping project working with indigenous people in the Pacific Northwest, or Cascadia, himself trying to apprentice himself beyond just a sort of a geologic type of watershed mapping to a deep cultural, spiritual way of native mapping and trying to learn from those traditions. And and I would think that's the way we would want to proceed with this. What emerges is one of two things. Either when one begins to learn native maps as much as we can as a cross-cultural exercise, one is that most native folk lived bioregionally. And often the traditional boundaries, which were not lines on maps, they were covenantal intercommunal understandings, tended to conform to watershed boundaries. One can see this very dramatically in Pacific Islanders, who I've worked very closely with over the years, where it's kind of straightforward. You have an island that's usually shaped by volcanic activity, and then you have a bunch of ridges running down to the sea, each of which is defined by the way the water flows, and each clan lived, and oftentimes, even though the languages differed, that was the definition of place, very watershed defined. And in a place like Hawaii, there's a really interesting heterocultural distribution up and down the watershed. The people by the ocean are fishermen, people in the Mid-Valley, plant taro, and the folk up the top of the watershed hunt. And then the trade goes up and down the valley. And so either that was pretty evident, and if that weren't the case, what was the case is that Native people knew the watershed. They didn't take that knowledge for granted. That was bedrock cultural knowledge, so-called TEK, traditional ecological knowledge. That's what we don't take for granted. And so, if nothing else, it's a step in the right direction, I would say. So that I think that would be my answer. There are ways, I think, to prevent this from becoming just another imposition of Western spatial divide and conquering. The other thing that I think prevents this, or has a natural resistance to the colonialism of whiteness that we're talking about, is the fact that, you know, nobody with any sense of ecological knowledge tries to argue that watersheds are autonomous units, right? Everything's interconnected. A watershed's just kind of one fairly straightforward, observable way of understanding that, but everything is connected. Every watershed is connected. Water is one, right? There's just only one source of water on the planet. The same amount of water exists today that existed in the beginning. So that's why Bob and Jim Bear this morning were talking about, you know, every drop is the whole. And the hydrologic cycle is not confined to watersheds. It's above and under. Aquifers have different boundaries. So that I would argue would prevent a watershed consciousness from becoming provincial, much less imperial. So that would be some ways to begin to think. But we always have to have that cautionary, you know, question. Any other just question of clarification? Yes, Mike.
Well, I was just thinking about how, I mean, we so often identify by our vocation, and you know, you mentioning the reality in Hawaii that you're speaking of those three. And how we use that to assign meaning to our lives. And maybe the result of remembering or a place or finding ourselves in a place of watershed is reimagining or redistributing or how we identify vocationally or how those vocations would exist. I don't know if I'm formulating a question or just formulating thoughts in my brain.
Yeah. Well, at the very least, one would hope that our vocations would be placed, replaced. And actually, certainly for the professional class, but also for poor people. The economy keeps people moving across the landscape following the money. So this is a battle with economic imperialism. Daniel Kemmes has written a book called Community and the Politics of Place, again about 30 years old now, a former mayor of Missoula, Montana, in which he was one of the early articulators of the idea of local economy. What would it mean to actually reimagine the economy in terms of bioregions? Of course, 99% of human economy on the history of the planet has been bioregional by design and by necessity. The real question to placeless insatiable appetites like ours is, can we begin to find new limits on not only economic consumption, but production and distribution? And one of the ways we see that, of course, over the last 20 years is in the local food movement. People are thinking not only in terms of watersheds, but food sheds, as you know, garbage sheds. Where does our garbage go? What does it mean that we import resources and export garbage, which we do, not only as nations, but as cities and counties? So what does it mean to start operating back within the limits of that, so we actually take responsibility for our own shit, quite literally? Just a couple more things. I want to make sure you know this guy, Brock Dolman. Gotta love that picture of Brock. Talk about immersing oneself in the watershed. Can you tell he's an old hippie? Okay, yeah, he is from California. What? But actually, the Occidental Art and Ecology Center and the Water Institute are really important early articulators of the watershed paradigm. And he has a beautiful little pamphlet that you can get for a buck called Basin of Relations. And he talks about watersheds underlying all human endeavors and forming the foundation of all future aspirations and survival. And he, oftentimes when he talks, he'll hold his hands out and cup them and talk about this basin of relations. That's what John Wesley Powell meant by an intentional form of community. We've got to re-enter community with all of the residents of the watershed. And he includes in that the hydrological cycle, the fire cycle, mineral extraction, resource extraction, production, and so on. And he calls this the basin of relations and talks about the watershed as a lifeboat. Now, he does not mean lifeboat in the sense of 1970s, what's the word that's escaping me, where you throw people out of the lifeboat? I can't come up with that word. Too tired. You know, where you sacrifice folk because there's only so much in the lifeboat. That's the white strategy. That's what we are currently doing. We are engineering things so that the effects of climate catastrophe will be felt first and worst by the poor and the marginalized, and the elites will insulate themselves by any means necessary. Triage. Thank you. He does not mean by this triage lifeboat. He's saying every watershed is a lifeboat. Let's treat it as if our lives depended on it, particularly in an emergency. If you're interested in bioregionalism, this is still, even though it's 30 years old, one of the best little primers by Kirkpatrick Sale. Somebody want to read that? Because it's another one of these pretty good little definitions. Go ahead.
Bio is from the Greek word for forms of life, and region is from the Latin regere, territory to be ruled. They convey together a life territory, a place defined by its life forms. Its topography is biota, rather than by human dictates. A region governed by nature, not legislature. And the concept initially strikes us as strange, that may perhaps only be a measure of how distant we have become from the wisdom it conveys.
So, I'd commend this book if you want to... Watershed being just kind of a subcategory, if you will, of bioregionalism. To me, this was the gateway drug to this way of thinking. And part of the reason for thinking this way is that a basic part of watershed citizenship is literacy. If you don't know the architecture of your watershed, you don't know the dominant flora group, you don't know what critters dwell naturally there, you can't tell the difference between a native plant and an invasive plant, and you don't care. You don't know what's edible. You don't know which direction storms come from. You don't know which way the water flows. That just reinforces the sense of living detached from the earth, living on top of places. Once you start apprenticing yourself to this, I can testify, it transforms you. And you start learning stuff that you never accessed in your education, especially not in your theological over-education, such as the one that I carry. And you start learning about place and the spirit of place. And you start learning to love stuff, the smell, the lay of the land on your eyes. This, in other words, this is not a new set of ideas. This is not an intellectual paradigm. This is a way of discipleship. And that is why the third part of this concept of this triple entendre is we need to be disciples of our watersheds. And I mean that in the very most biblical way. The region, the bioregion, is our rabbi. God will teach us through the land. It's the oldest pedagogy on the planet. And we need to recover it. So that's the journey of replacement. And I'll just put these things up one more time so you can see it. This is what we're pushing. And we're pushing hard. We really are. And what's really exciting is that it is resonating. Watershed discipleship communities are springing up. In Mennonite congregations, the entire Mountain States Conference of the Mennonite Church is embracing a watershed pedagogy. Episcopalians. There's a brand new watershed discipleship community as a special ministry of the Anglican Church of British Columbia. Has just been founded by our friend Laurel Dykstra. The Kairos Canada movement has adopted it as part of its program. There are people in, we had that great up and down the watershed gathering 18 months ago in Albuquerque with people from the headwaters in Colorado all the way down to where you all were near the mouth of the Rio Grande. And you all have been working, Stephen, building some relations up and down that watershed. That's a different new way of being ecumenical and being missionary, as it were. So it's an exciting thing that seminaries are, we just came from a group of seminaries that's embracing this. African American churches are awakening to this in some really interesting ways. That was just at Trinity UCC in Chicago, and they're building an eco village right there in South Chicago and talking about this kind of stuff. I just think it's really exciting. Now, what it means in practice is that is that it means practice. It means changing our habits, large and small. No change is too small, and no change is too large, given the crisis. And I want to ask Aaron if you maybe come up and talk a little bit about the piece that Interfaith Light and Power is doing as one of the early ecumenical organizing efforts. Talk a little bit about it. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm reflecting on this concept of place. And there's an author, Bill Plotkin, who wrote Nature and the Human Soul, and he refers to soul as place, and that our finding our own souls is connected to finding our true place in the world, and that's connected to right relationship with everything. And so a lot of the way that we organize at Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light is around that concept of how is it that we are still called to develop spiritually and relationally and emotionally together as a way of responding to the crises that we face. And so we go into communities. It's an interfaith nonprofit. It's an affiliate organization, so we're our own thing, but there's a nationwide organization as well. And we look at responding to the climate crisis in three different ways. One, practical solutions. How is it that we can conserve and reduce our carbon footprint and create carbon sinks and energy efficiency and community solar gardens? And then there's the systemic, the movement building work. So how is it that we link together all of the individual actions that affect policy, that shift culture, that help us feel connected. So the fossil fuel divestment movement is one of those big things. The People's Climate March that was in New York, raise your hand if you were there. 200, 300 people from the Twin Cities. We went by bus together, camped along the way. And so the third leg of the stool is the spiritual, the relational. That idea that Albert Einstein said, which is you cannot solve a problem from the same level of consciousness that created it. How is it that we move from considering the problems and the temptation to seek solutions from that place into our hearts, into our commonly held values, and be informed from that place so that we create solutions that are actually just and sustainable? So we've been doing climate conversations all around the state and now around the Midwest, going into communities where it is still a polarizing issue to talk about climate change, and asking people to connect to what they share in common around relationships, around connection to nature, and how does that inform us as we face the challenges? How is that a point of resiliency? What can we do to nurture those relationships? And then what do we learn about each other? What are our gifts? What are the assets that each individual community has that can inform a response that's actually really inspired based on the people that are there? So we have lots of on-ramps to action, but we don't prescribe them. It's more about asking people to step up and become leaders and organizers themselves to widen the circle of engagement within their own faith community and beyond. So it's exciting, it's growing, it's such an honor to be here, and more to be finding out how is it that we can work at the intersections. I think that at the People's Climate March, it was actually a People's Climate March, and there were people articulating the common stake we have in the climate from unions and labor, from community organizers to faith, to 50,000 students, and there was a moment of silence that was coordinated amongst over 500,000 people. We became silent and we held this space of solidarity for all the people who are suffering right now due to climate change. And we were in Central Park and we could hear birds and car doors, and people started weeping as we began to feel not alone in the heartache and the grief. And I began to hear a sound behind me, and I didn't know what it was. And then I started to feel scared because it was so immense. I thought about running, and then it got closer, and I realized that it was a wall of sound that was moving up a half a mile behind me and through us, everybody calling for change. And it moved through me and beyond, and I was struck by the power and wondered what could remain unsolved, you know, in the face of that kind of collective stake in humanity that we shared. So that's the movement. It's emerging. You know, the Pope's encyclical came out all about climate change. We have the Paris climate talks coming up in December. And there's such a growing movement that it's hard to coordinate any days of action anymore because everybody's doing something in their place. And I think that that's really powerful as we track the life or the river flow of this movement. So MNIPL, if you are local at all, if you're involved in any faith community, we do a lot of work with youth and with children. And I would love to talk with you and find out how we could partner with you and your community. Thanks.
Can you name the thing that you all are doing here locally that you're most excited about?
Well, there's a few things. There's community solar gardens. So in Minnesota, there's right now, in Xcel Energy is doing their best to slow everything down so that they don't have to actually install the amount of solar that they are obligated to. But there's a lot of opportunities. We're doing, we've created a Just Community Solar Coalition, and it's first, its kind of flagship project is a solar array that's going to be on Shiloh Temple in North Minneapolis, and people can buy into the shares for that array, and it's a cheaper than regular energy cost. And then people are going to be doing job training so that the people who are hired to install these arrays are actually from the community in which the community solar is going to be, and it's going to be helping to close the jobs employment gap. So that's really exciting. That's really new. It's hard. It's negotiating and wrestling with solar companies saying, no, we're not asking for charity. We're asking for to create a system in which solar energy is accessible and equitable to everybody. So I'm really excited about that. And then, you know, there's we're doing Paris parties. And so we're going into faith communities and doing that kind of asset mapping that I was talking about, celebrating where people have been and strategizing where they can go and telling their stories. And we're going to take that as a delegation to Paris. So thanks.
I was just in Chicago before coming here, and one of the Interfaith Power and Light affiliates there is working with a multicultural African-American-led group called Faith in Place, and there's some very exciting organizing going on in Chicago. I also want to underline that, you know, everything gets balkanized in Empire, and that, not least social movements. It is a real political and spiritual discipline for us to work at the intersections and actually build real collaborations. Some of the most exciting work being done in this area is being done by marginalized poor folk. The Gulf Coast Rising movement that's been working on post-Katrina issues for 10 years now, we just celebrated or commemorated the 10-year anniversary, is doing amazing militant organizing. Their slogan is, the sea is rising and so are we, all led by poor folk throughout the Gulf South. Amazing multicultural movement in Houston called Ecotone, and their faith-based movement, and their slogan is, how do we affect ecological atonement? So you know, this is not any longer a white folk concern, as I think it had been perceived in the past. In fact, we need to erase whiteness from this movement, deconstruct it, as Jen was talking about last night, because this is a struggle for survival. But the fundamental allies are Native folk, poor folk, who are in motion. And this afternoon, we're going to get to hear about one of the most significant, in my opinion, one of the most significant movements in North America, which is the Water Walkers movement, as a spiritual and political movement that is actually remapping our consciousness around water. So I'm really looking forward to hearing from Sharon. Yes?
the work with against Enbridge and all of the pipelines and you were talking about the Alberta tar sands. And that has been a real point of collaboration and solidarity with many Indigenous folks, you know, the environmental or the Indigenous Environmental Network and Honor the Earth. And so we're trying to get folks to show up to all of their events and, you know, down and doing lots of public testimony. And we just had a big win in terms of a pipeline not being approved. And that was really, really huge after several years of work. So, yeah, thank you.
There are many levels to this struggle, of course, and one of them are the kinds of political alliances and issues that we have to struggle around, together on. Another is the very intimate sort of personal practices, particularly at the household level. We have to stop living in the ways that we're living in terms of our consumption. and the ways that we put that heavy imprint on the land. For the last 15 years, we've been working on the notion of Sabbath economics, as many of you know, as an attempt to address these issues at the household level. That's actually the workshop that Aaron and John Hildebrand were going to lead. We have a few resources on Sabbath economics down at the table. But what I want to spend our last 20 minutes on is doing a little brainstorming together about particularly the ecclesial dimensions of watershed discipleship. How do we do church differently based on the kinds of things that we've talked about? Sorry, that's Baba. You know Baba by now. You've all got all that memorized. But you gotta let Saint Wendell have a say. You know, we all know that he emphasizes the local, but his analysis is not an unsophisticated one, and he thinks that part of the pathology of whiteness is that you have to have big solutions to the big problems. And he's really drawing on old wisdom here, that actually change is made at the local level by communities reclaiming their integrity and accepting responsibilities. So that's one way that he says it. Another way that he says it, in a really interesting piece he wrote back in 1989, The Futility of Global Thinking, which was a shot across the bow of globalization. Really, the question is not how we save the planet, but how we save each watershed. And I think that's a question I'm interested in terms of what it means to be church, and particularly in light of the transition movement that I assume that you all are at least broadly familiar with, which is a network of small communities that are trying to transition from oil dependency to local resilience. One of its slogans is also captured by Arthur Ashe's famous statement. This is about starting where we are, using what we have, and doing what we can. The first book on the transition movement for churches came out last year out of the UK by a theologian friend, Tim Gorringe. And so I'm really interested in the question of what it means to be ecclesial communities of place, and what kinds of things are you all experimenting with? This, as we say in Sabbath economics work, this is a way of deprivatizing our anxiety and communitizing our imagination. So, what are ways just at doing and being church that can begin to be replaced and realigned around some of these models? Yes.
Question related to that was raised in my Aaron's report. The watershed movement or moment as it's emerging in the ELCA local synod is focused on the watershed.
Awesome.
And we seem to be really quite separate from climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Action.
Yeah.
Can you reach that gap?
Well, again, you know, that's the reason why we're kind of hammering away on this mantra. We can't just be talking about discipleship in our watersheds, although we have to talk about that, without also talking about the watershed moment. And you can't talk about the watershed moment without talking about climate catastrophe. So that's very specifically why we're saying all three of these things are important and need to be part of the integration. And so, you know, hopefully you can float that a little bit. Because otherwise it can become just another kind of privileged dabbling in environmental, you know, which frankly, even though eco-theology and creation care kinds of movements have probably been the most significant social movements in the churches over the last 25 years across the denominational spectrum. That's the good news. The bad news is that creation care tends to be miles wide and inches deep. and we've got to go way deeper. But at least we have a foothold, and you've got a huge foothold now, it sounds like, in the synod. So this is the time, and to make sure that we don't domesticate these things. Because, you know, churches are famous for going partway and not being interested in the deep. And our, I think our job in social movements is to keep pushing and pulling. But again, I'm really interested in constructive experiments that folks are a part of. Yeah.
Well, I have a question which I think also has ecclesiological implications. One thing that I'm seeing as you talk about this transition movement is I see in my work, I work in a nonprofit that's not faith-based, mm-hmm. I'm a new faith-based work on the side. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I see nationally in this trend is that people are beginning to understand that the suburban experiment that we've done over the last 60 years is not sustainable, that car, oil stuff is not sustainable. They're moving into the center of cities,
yep.
Building transit, walking and biking as a means to get to work, and displacing the people that have been there for a long time.
That's right.
And so when I think about physiology, for me, I think it has implications on how we address that, but I also have concerns around what gentrification, how we unpack gentrification and displacement in light of that, what that means for our church communities, but what it also means for our broader communities in this watershed moment. Because
great.
We see that as white people are getting enlightened, it's another way of recolonizing black and brown bodies
that
we're forced to the suburbs where we don't have resources.
Forced to the deteriorating suburbs that were built in the 50s for white folk. Yeah. And just a great, insightful question and problem. Gentrification, let's face it. Urban redevelopment strategies for 70 years now have been all about gentrification. First, white folk want to move out to the suburbs. Then white folk want to move back in. Transportation corridors have always accommodated those moves of the managerial class. Going through or over black and brown communities. And now, you know, this gentrified version of re-inhabiting the city because you'll have a better carbon footprint. That has to be part of our analysis so that we don't fall into that because we're kind of mapped that way, right? Gentrification always leads the creative edge of urban redevelopment. Chad Schwitter's here with Urban Homeworks, I think, is part of this struggle here in Twin Cities. Do you want to say a word maybe just about anything come to mind for you, Chad, in response to this question?
Well, I think, number one, it's really tough one because, you know, in my neighborhood on the north side, we could use some more disposable income bouncing around. So the question is, who gets to be the new gentry in our neighborhood? And so how do we create bridges and pathways for people who are already here to participate and to own houses and to own the land? So I think, it is a continual struggle. And I think there's some great opportunities that lie in there too. And while doing that, making sure that the transactions that happen in order to produce that housing and produce those opportunities don't get exported on the first crack and leave the community. So I think, our goal is to try to figure out, or our goal is to increase the number of households of that are already in our community to be able to buy the home. So right now we're trending at about 93% of the homeowners are people that have either remained in the community and want to, or people who want to return. And about 83% of the economic transactions that go into the housing production are absorbed by local and minority and women-owned businesses.
Thanks, Jeff. One of the interesting edges of opportunity on this question, again, is the thing that is widely lamented by our mainstream denominations, which is the phenomenon of old inner-city hulking churches with all kinds of infrastructure, aging, and dwindling congregations, and the temptation to sort of gentrify and develop along the lines of traditional urban development or sell off these spaces. What would it mean to re-inhabit these spaces with these kinds of concerns in mind? And the suburbanizing of the church, you know, ecclesial trends tend to lag 15 to 20 years behind mainstream culture. And so it hasn't yet dawned on at least mainstream churches, much less evangelical churches, that they ought to join the action of moving back into the city. So here's all this brick and mortar. What would it mean if those communities, without gentrifying them, could be transformed into demonstration projects of resiliency? On all the corners, in all the some of the toughest neighborhoods, there is no reason why we can't be transitioning from lawns to gardens, showing the gospel rather than just telling the gospel through water catchment and alternative energy experiments, permaculture, and doing that with folk in the neighborhood, not a bunch of green yuppies moving in with their hipster vibe, but partnering with folk in the community who actually know a whole lot more about resiliency than white folks ever will. These are real challenges for our movement. This is not easy stuff, but it is where the conversation needs to be. The life of the church, Sarah, right? Sarah Holst there has worked with a group we are close to out in the Ventura watershed and called the Abundant Table Network. And Sarah, would you say a word about the localized, the liturgy work you guys have done, which I think really resonates?
Yeah, absolutely. So we just moved to a different farm, actually. It's about a 5-acre organic farm focused on both ecological sustainability, but also farm worker rights, and have really experimented with homegrown communion. So what it means to trace back all of our liturgical elements to our own place. So for us, that meant growing our own wheat, baking our own bread. Our first batch of wheat, unfortunately, got infested by mice in the shed. So again, like bathing in the dirty water, saying this is the process of doing this kind of thing. Sometimes it's wildly experimental and doesn't work, but those are kind of the experiments that lead us to doing it in a less broken way. So right now I am actually working on a study guide to kind of look at all of the liturgical elements in that way. So from wheat and wine to the linens on the altar to the significance of oil and water in baptisms, thinking about. So there are a lot of olive trees in the Holy Land, and that's why we have olive oil. But what kind of oil would we use? And just asking communities to think about where their places are and what kind of liturgical elements make sense for them to use. And tracing back the things that they're already using, what their sources were, but then thinking about more sustainable ways to do that as well. Maybe that's all I'll share for now.
And Sarah and Nate are just in Duluth, for those of you in the watershed here, working on these issues. We reproduce alienation in all sorts of cultural forms, not least in our churches, right? And everything from the architecture of a sanctuary that's set up as spectator and performance rather than community conversation and worship, to the material existence of our churches. What kinds of materials do we use? Who made them? Where do they come from? Let's not care more about fair trade coffee than we do about fair trade vestments or bread. So these, it seems to me, these are important. And the liturgy, you know, I ended with this in the plenary, but I just want to underline it again. We have at the heart of our tradition a liturgical expression of discipleship called baptism that leads us right into the watershed, but only if we undomesticate it. Only if we undomesticate it. There is so much potential there. if we replace ornamental horticulture on the altar after doing bloody battle with the Ladies' Altar Guild with native plants, it becomes a conversation and an education as opposed to a reproduction of alienation. Not that I'm against roses, but I kind of am. Because we're missing an opportunity in every way that we be and do church. Now, we're talking about the struggle of urban redevelopment, gentrification, one of the most dramatic cases anywhere in the country right now of watershed discipleship as water justice is happening in Detroit. Lindsay Airy here is associated with us at BCM, and she's working in Detroit alongside of friends. Lindsay, talk about the meaning of water under the altar.
Yeah, water under the altar. Well, I walked in as you were asking your question, and I almost raised my hand like, this would be a good time for me to talk about watershed discipleship in the Detroit River watershed, especially for a white person like me who's from Southern California. My husband and I moved to Detroit a year ago under mentorship connection that Ched connected us with Bill Wiley Kellerman, who's a longtime Detroiter activist and pastor and theologian in the city. And so he's the pastor at St. Peter's Episcopal Church, which is in the middle of a pretty much already done being gentrified neighborhood. And it's part of how we struggle of like, oh, if we didn't have this building, we could do a lot more. But we have to worry about all this building stuff. But part of keeping the building is we got to hold this space down. There's a soup kitchen. We have our man and meal guests that are very much a part of our congregation. But what Ched is speaking to with the water under the altar is, so for those who don't know, massive water shutoffs, upwards of 30,000 households in the past year have been being perpetrated on residents in the neighborhoods, mostly black and brown. In fact, I work with We the People of Detroit, which some of their main work is connecting these issues and advocating for water affordability in the city. But I help coordinate the hotline, and Of all the people that have called in, I've only interacted with one white person who's been shut off. Most of them have been African American. And so at St. Peter's, we're one of four water stations for the city, which is emergency water for those who have been shut off that we deliver. Which is not at all a long-term fix. It's an act of compassion. But that's a part of what we do. When Tom and I moved and threw in with St. Peter's in our own watershed discipleship, we were sprinkled with water that's been donated, from Canada, from the UAW in Chicago, from different congregations across the South and all over North America, mixed with the Detroit River water, which is also big threats of being the land around there being privatized. That is a big part of who St. Peter's is to be a space that's about justice and that's also about compassion in the midst of the city's perpetration. Also, the city's been under emergency management and currently is no longer. So we have our first white mayor that was democratically elected. He was a write-in candidate, and most of the write-ins on the ballots were in the same penmanship, who's basically just carrying out what the emergency manager wrote into the new city charter, which was basically dictatorial powers. Everything that we've done all over the global South for the last century, now that kind of economic political readjustment happening in Detroit. So for my own discipleship, beloved Detroit, which we like to call it because there's so much shame perpetrated of it's your fault, you're not paying your water bill, so it's your fault. And when we go door to door, people will often deny that their water is shut off because there is so much shame to it. But how I'm being discipled is this organization that's led by five African-American women who have long time been in the city, live below the poverty level themselves. We don't have a lot of money or funding, but we're talking to people in Venezuela and in Bolivia who have gone down this road of privatization way before us and trying to connect the dots. And so they're really leading. They were huge instrumental in bringing the UN in November to do an investigation, declare what was happening with water shutoffs as a human rights abuse. But they're barely scraping by themselves. And so I think my own discipleship is in watching them, that there isn't an escape hatch for them. Like, they're not leaving. They can't leave. That's their place. The people who are being pushed out, that's their place. And in seeing the deep compassion and care in the midst of this is what climate change, climate catastrophe is looking like in our place, and how are we going to do this together? So Monica Lewis Patrick, one of the heads of our organization, anytime we do get new funding, she brings on someone else that needs a job to work with us. She doesn't get her own self paid. And I think just that idea of wealth in community, not wealth in resources, financial, economic resources, has been deeply, deeply shaping and confronting of my own white supremacy and self-sufficiency, isolation. Did you want me to say anything more specifically? I feel like I can go so many directions.
So just say a word about the water under the altar and the sign you had over it. It's just so beautiful, liturgically.
The sign over the altar. I'm blanking.
Something about rather than Eucharistic words, it was about, you know, the water of life for the people with water under the altar. Just a beautiful expression of take this water. That's kind of where we are. So this is a really important movement, and corner Lindsay sometime during the rest of the day and get more details if you're interested.
Yeah, and if you want to know more, our pastor Bill has actually written a ton about the history, and then how that's the current colonizing forces are perpetuating just the white flight that's happened through the decades and all of the. So I can send you links to things.
Thank you, Lindsay. Give it up for Detroit. We need to bring this circle to a close. And I want to, first of all, thank each of you for making the effort to participate in this 24-hour baptism. I know it's intense, a lot going on. I hope you'll take a moment to connect with somebody you didn't know before. Don't leave here without having done that. And I pray that as we embrace this watershed moment of catastrophe, and as we re-inhabit our watersheds, and as we decide to follow the way of discipleship, apprenticing to our bioregions, that we will do that ever mindful of the ways that can just become a new construct of privilege or exclusion, and really make sure that we are reaching out right across the watershed. Every watershed in this Great Turtle Island has not only the story of injustice and violence mapped into its landscape, but also current conditions of marginalization and inequity. And it's our strong belief that a watershed discipleship paradigm will lead the way in reintegrating social justice and ecological justice concerns that have been too long balkanized, to realize they are not different issues, ever. But we've got to embody that in our work, watershed by watershed. So just reach out and take the hand of somebody next to you. And Jay's going to lead us in one more round of wade in the water. Come on, Baptists.
Yeah, do you want me to do the Baba Diyun intro? All right, so do those three remembering of we won't save a place that we don't love. Won't save a place that we don't love. River flows down to the valley from the mountain above. We won't love a place that we don't know. Realize what should die so the good can grow. You can't know a place that you haven't learned. Bust down the dams and let the river return. And we can wade in the water. Wade in the water, children, wade in the water. God's gonna trouble the water.
All right.
Thanks, everybody.